But now on Radio 4, if you fancy a blast of cold air to blow away any Christmas cobwebs that might already be forming, then here's everyone's favourite mistress of bar humbug. It's Lynn Truss with Lynn Truss's Christmas Rant.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight.
The season of goodwill to all men is a pretty laughable concept these days, of course. But I discovered just how strange and old-fashioned the idea has become when, on a recent promotional tour of America, an email came in from a listener to a radio station in Monterey, California. I was connected to Monterey at the time from a ninth-floor hotel room in Denver, Colorado, where, outside the window, illuminated snowflakes were dancing against a dark sky in a Hollywood Christmas kind of way, and downstairs in the lobby an immense and lovely tree had been erected, in the middle of November, to encourage a premature Yuletide mood. Christmas started radically early in the US this year, i.e. well before Thanksgiving, and there was a rumour that the cynical forces behind the commercialisation of the season had deliberately timed their assault to get shoppers well into credit card debt before they received their first heating bills. The cads. Anyway, the world outside was feverishly Christmassy when I was on the phone to sunny Monterey and heard the viewpoint that kind of stopped me in my tracks. We'd been talking about the importance of having respect for strangers, and the emailer evidently objected to the tenor of the conversation. "I respect people only when they prove to me they deserve it," the writer explained rather piously. "Until they prove this to me, I don't see why I should have any time for them at all." Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, I thought wearily, as I stared at the swirling snow outside. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. I've been confronting rather a lot of topsy-turvy thinking over the past few months. There's an idea that you get to a certain point in your life and you find your fond old notions of how the world should be ordered have been carelessly dropped in the march of progress and trampled in the dust. But I keep finding that mine have not been discarded, just wrenched round to face the other way. Everything's back to front. The innocent party has become the guilty one in any number of situations. I'm beginning to think that I must have been dozing one day in front of a Victorian nursery fire with a couple of kittens, and then, in a dream state, climbed up on the mantelpiece, showing my stripy stockings, and stepped right through a looking-glass. A man tries to buy a cup of tea at Frankfurt Airport. He waits half an hour to be served, then another half hour to get his cup of tea, and when it arrives, it's the wrong thing. He's now due to catch his flight, so he says, "I'm sorry, I can't have anything now, I've got to catch my flight." And the server, instead of apologising for wasting an hour of his time, says in an accusing tone, "Well, you've had a nice long sit-down here at our expense, haven't you?" On a station platform in Connecticut, damp Big Apple commuters huddle under shelters on a rainy day until a woman in a fur coat joins them under the shelter, produces her mobile phone, and instead of saying, "Does anyone mind if I make a call?" says instead, "Can I have some privacy here?" A bookshop owner gently takes a book from a child and says, "Let's put that back on the shelf before it gets damaged, shall we?" And the parent says, "I heard how you just spoke to my child. I want you to apologise, and I want you to mean it." On the phone to Monterey, I said that the emailer's view was actually the opposite of my own, and that I was honestly a bit shocked by how arrogant it was. "I think," I said, "that we should assume that people do deserve respect until we know them well enough to find out that they don't. People are supposed to be presumed innocent until they're found guilty, not the other way round. Surely we should give strangers the benefit of the doubt." Obviously what I wanted to add was, "And who the hell does this guy think he is?" But of course I didn't say that because, obviously, I didn't know him well enough. A lot of old Christmas sayings may have to change if this is the way things are going. "God bless us every one" will have to go for a start. "God bless us a select few, just the people I know personally who've scored 70% or above on my special worthiness tests." Charles Dickens's timeless A Christmas Carol would never, I suggest, have caught on quite so widely with such a conditional closing line. "O come all ye faithful" becomes "O come a small but specially selected percentage of ye faithful." The trouble is that ever since Christmas became essentially a feast of manic and anxious shopping for one's nearest and dearest, it's been harder to remember that we're all just items of common humanity brought together by a humbling communal festivity. Christmas is pretty divisive. It makes each of us feel specially and individually stressed. Indeed, anyone susceptible as I am to the unattractive emotion of self-pity tends to say, "Why me?" rather a lot at Christmas, sometimes with an actual catch in the voice, "Why me?" Despite the fact that, quite obviously, everyone else is going through precisely the same stresses and strains, although perhaps they started earlier and posted early for Christmas and everything, so are pretty infuriating to have anything to do with. Personally, as I trail around the shops at Christmas, I find that I'm unable to stop myself from exercising a redundant reflex. I keep seeing ideal gifts for people who are no longer alive. I imagine I'm not alone in this. It's not tragic or anything. Besides, there's nothing you can do about it. It's just another of the ways that Christmas tugs at you and reminds you of bigger matters, such as mortality, the inexorability of time, and the unreprogrammable nature of the human mind. That colour would suit Dad, I think. My sister would have loved that. Every year I used to buy my grandmother the latest edition of the Friendship book, and since they've continued to publish it, I still spot it 13 years after her death, and have a brief spasm of loss as I realise there's no one to buy it for. The worst for me is my sister, because for about 40 consecutive years I worked incredibly hard to find things she would like. Her birthday fell just a week before Christmas, so there was a lot at stake in my desperate December wanderings, especially if I decided to chance my arm, combine the two occasions, and buy her something large and risky, like a coat. When I got it right, as when I bought her a very successful shoulder bag for 19 and 6 when I was 12, I felt ecstatic. But I didn't always get it right. Just a year or so before she died, I made a disastrous choice, giving her a voucher for a facial at Selfridges, thinking she'd consider it a high old luxury to have a bit of personal pampering in a smart shop. Instead, she was horrified. A facial? Was this a message of some sort? Was I saying she needed a facial? I quickly realised that had I given her a brown paper bag with "Place Overhead" printed on it, she couldn't have been more offended. So I'm still trying, I suppose. There's a bit of my brain that's still looking for the perfect gift. The thing about my sister was that she had very definite tastes, which ought to have made the whole thing quite easy. In fact, why didn't I ever buy her a pile of lovely crisp bed linen, which transparently would have made her very, very happy? My sister loved, with a kind of intensity that made her love's absolutely defining of her personality, many things. In no particular order, crisp white linen, T.E. Lawrence, anything about ancient Egypt, Wallace and Gromit, travelling light, nice nails, white flowers, Frasier, the code word puzzle in the Daily Mail, Dame Edna Everidge, dry white wine, coffee, Hellman's mayonnaise, Jane Eyre, smoking, silver jewellery, large wristwatches, round necklines, Radio 4, English rugby, Wimbledon fortnight, John Humphreys, decorated plimsolls, and cheese. In other words, she was a brilliantly high-definition person to buy gifts for. The dislikes were just as strongly articulated, and in some cases rather crudely oppositional to the likes, but this made them all the easier to remember. If silver was good, gold was tacky. Coloured flowers were naff. As far as Lawrence's went, D.H. was vastly inferior to T.E. No one looked good in a V-neck. Wuthering Heights was overrated. Red wine was unsophisticated. And football was a game for hooligans. I'm glad I find this list so easy to remember. I know that I always shall. As I ponder it, though, the thing that makes me emotional is the thought of the ice buckets I bought for her around 1970 when she was newly married, and I, a teenager, thought for some reason was the perfect gift. It was probably around this time that I bought my dad a hip flask, in the full knowledge that he almost never drank. I was somehow convinced by my feverish study of Christmas catalogues that all men wanted either a silver-plated hip flask contained in a leather holder, a gift set of Old Spice, which he got as well, a desk tidy in the shape of a golf bag, or a novelty jigsaw representing a plate of baked beans. It must have been strange being a man at that time, especially a man whose main interest was watching westerns on the telly, and who neither fished nor golfed nor motored, nor wanted to spend 5 hours of Christmas holding up bits of artfully cut cardboard and squinting at them in a defeated kind of way through inadequate bifocals. Luckily, I've blanked out my sister's reaction to the ice bucket, which was plastic and turquoise blue, incidentally, so very much of its period. But on the plus side, she did keep it for the next 30 years, using it as a biscuit barrel, so it served some kind of purpose. But what can she have thought? Was I sending some veiled message about her needing to give more cocktail parties, to drink less white wine, more gin and tonic? I suppose we all buy crap presents sometimes, but I still want to make it up to her. A big pile of crisp linen, a bouquet of white flowers, a hamper of cheese, a ticket to Cairo, a rugby shirt with Fraser's face and a quotation from T. Lawrence. I'd give anything, basically. And at Christmas I can convince myself that she knows that, wherever she is. She knows I'd give anything. Obviously, Christmas is a time to concentrate on the people we know and the people we used to know. But I still think we should remember that the people we don't know might be worth knowing and treat them accordingly. And I think the man in Monterey is missing out on a lot if he assumes he should exhibit goodwill only to people who've given him individual calls. I've been talking about nothing but alienation for the past 3 months, so you'll have to forgive me for being a bit gloomy and monomaniacal on the subject of treating strangers as though they actually had equal rights to exist on the planet. I'm just sick of the what's-it-got-to-do-with-you reaction that seems to be on the increase. Your child is being obnoxious, sir. What's it got to do with you? You shouldn't be graffitiing that wall. What's it got to do with you? Recently I said, excuse me, as I walked past a boy making a video, and I heard his friend say, what did she say to you? Hearing this, I actually went back and explained that I was being polite, and that excuse me was a quite well-recognised form of apologising for getting in someone's way. They just thought I was bonkers. It's surely only a short step in these trying times to, well, have a nice Christmas, little lad. What's it got to do with you? F off, you fat cow. It's a bit late on Christmas Eve to say, let's all wish everyone we see a Merry Christmas, because most people are now safe indoors with their own families and won't see any strangers again until after the festivities, or at least until the sales start in roughly 36 hours' time. Personally, I'm planning to stay indoors for the next month at least, finishing up the chocks and making my famous Christmas pudding risotto, followed by Sprout Surprise, the surprise being it's just sprouts, rather than face the shops again. But I do have the excuse that I'm very, very tired, having been in Denver and everything. Meanwhile, for the sake of the chap in Monterey, I'll just finish with a quick seasonal verse. Oh, the holly bears a bark as bitter as any gall, and Mary bore sweet Jesus Christ for to redeem a few people who get my personal stamp of approval. That needs a bit of work. Merry Christmas.
So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
That was Lynn Truss's Christmas rant, and the programme was produced in Bristol by Viv Beebe.